Welcome back. Over the last few lectures, I've been talking a good deal about archaeological theory, and particularly about the evolutionary theory that archaeologists use to understand the development of ancient states and civilizations. At this point now, we're going to move away from theory and to actual archaeological cases. It's the point at which my students in my courses at Bowdoin usually breathe a sigh of relief. But I want to emphasize, yet again, the relevance and the importance of those theoretical concepts to the understanding of how these processes take place. This is not merely a descriptive pursuit. It aims to be an explanatory pursuit as well. So we're going to begin our examination of the origins of states in the Near East. Certainly one of the first areas where these political forms develop, and archaeologically one of the best known areas in the world. And we're going to begin in the area that's known as Mesopotamia, the land between the two rivers, the Tigris and Euphrates rivers, in what's now Iraq and Iran. V. Gordon Child said, if you remember, that agriculture seems to be an essential basis for civilization everywhere it appears. So, two of the questions that we now have to begin to ask ourselves as we examine these archaeological data are, first, is that the case? And second, are there particular agricultural systems that seem to be necessary for civilizations to form? Do states only appear in some environmental circumstances and not in others? Are there some lower limits to agricultural productivity below which the political and social structures that support states will not form? And if so, what are those lower limits? As we'll see, these are complex questions. There do seem to be some commonalities in the ways in which states form in different parts of the world. But there are also fascinating exceptions to almost any rule that we archaeologists attempt to come up with. By the 6th millennium BC, village-based farming was firmly established across Western Asia, from the island of Cyprus to Megar in Pakistan. And we're going to talk actually about both of these areas, the Eastern Mediterranean and the peripheries of the Indus Valley, as centers of state formation in later periods. Throughout this vast area, from Eastern Europe through Western Asia to South Asia, farmers are using more or less the same set of Near Eastern domesticates. Wheat, barley, peas and beans, sheep, goats, and cattle. So we have this common system of agriculture, which seems to first develop along the eastern shores of the Mediterranean and then spread in an extraordinarily successful manner through much of Europe and Asia. And this is the time period, 6000 BC, it's the time period at which this spread is actually taking place. We've actually already seen most of these domesticates at Çatalhöyük in Anatolia. And this is approximately the same time period we're talking about now. Çatalhöyük has already at this point been occupied for more than 1,000 years. At Çatalhöyük, as I said, most of those domesticates existed except for cattle. And it's actually the case that cattle were domesticated in some areas at this time period, but not everywhere. In fact, as we're going to see, there seems to be an independent domestication of cattle in a variety of different areas of the world. And this is actually quite important because these large, significant domesticated animals become not merely economically important, but ideologically important to significant communities in different parts of the old world. In all of this large area then, from Cyprus to Pakistan, at 6000 BC, it appears that political authority remained local and dispersed. There's little evidence of social hierarchy, of social rank. People were living in generally quite egalitarian communities of usually some hundreds of people. These are small, dispersed, scattered farming communities. With political authority not extended beyond the single community. That is, we're not seeing situations where certain villages are ruling over other villages. So political authority was more or less restricted to particular communities, and within those communities it was pretty evenly dispersed. We're not seeing any evidence at 6000 BC of great social differences within these communities. How do we know this archaeologically? Well, there's a variety of different sorts of evidence that archaeologists use to think about social hierarchy and social rank in ancient times. Generally, it seems that at 6000 BC through this area, households, as we excavate them, are pretty similar within particular communities. That is, we're not finding evidence that certain people are living in very large households comparatively with very valuable or expensive household goods compared to other people in the same community. On the other hand, there seems to be an absence of situations in which populations are living in great poverty compared to their neighbors as well. The same is true of burials. Most people at 6000 BC over this vast area are being buried in more or less the same way as other people living in their community. We have no real evidence of warfare, at least warfare on any significant level, through this vast area. At least local trading systems existed over much of this region. Much of this was probably what archaeologists call down-the-line trade, where goods are passed via middlemen from one community to the next, sometimes over long distances. This is a trading system that doesn't require specialized traders. One trades with the next village over, which in turn may exchange that material for goods from someplace still further on. In this case, farmers would have undertaken this trade. The one significant exception, if you like, to this generalized down-the-line trade is we have some evidence for trade on Mediterranean islands. And that implies the existence of sailors, people in coastal communities with enough expertise to make sea voyages over sometimes substantial distances to places like that village on Cyprus. In northern Mesopotamia, in the period between about 6250 and 5300 BC, farming communities are often grouped under what's called the Hassunan tradition, as in other areas, small villages and local trading systems characterize the Hassunan, with no evidence of any real social differentiation within villages. These Hassunan villages were groups of freestanding structures. They're quite unlike the aggregate settlement at Çatalhöyük. And if you remember at Çatalhöyük, it was all of the households were grouped together in one large aggregate. Here we see, for example, a Hassunan building. And one interesting question then is why this Çatalhöyük community form seems to have been abandoned. There's also interesting architectural evidence from these Hassunan sites about the development of household systems in the Near East. The earliest level at the type site, Tel Hassuna, dates to about 6200 BC. And it appears that at that point, people were living in small houses suitable to hold a single nuclear family, mother, father, and children. As time goes on at the site, at Tel Hassuna, these domestic structures, these households, get larger. They're capable of holding 15 to 20 people. This seems to indicate that people began to live together as extended families, not nuclear families. Perhaps father and mother with their grown children and the families of their children, or at least some of their children, in the same household. In these cases, we expect that these groups of related people would form an agricultural work unit. And this is one solution to the periodic labor shortages that these simple agricultural systems often involve. We often see in these systems that there are periodically real shortages of labor. This is an agricultural system being powered entirely by human labor. There's also, however, at Tel Hassuna, the type site for this tradition, a large central building which was possibly used for communal storage. This may imply some degree of centralized coordination of labor for the community. I want to just stop here for a moment and introduce two new terms that you may not have heard before. A tel, as in Tel Hassuna, the name of the site, is a kind of archaeological site that we find in areas where mud brick or adobe architecture is in use. It's an artificial mound, sometimes extremely large, made up of the remains of mud brick houses that have been built, occupied, and abandoned over periods of centuries, mixed in often with domestic debris and garbage. So these tel sites are characteristic of, for example, Mesopotamia. A type site, if Tel Hassuna is the type site for the Hassunan tradition, a type site is the site that a particular ancient culture is named after. It's often the first site of that culture to have been found, and it will be important in the original definition of that culture's characteristics for archaeologists. In fact, this is often a problem for archaeologists. What happens if the type site isn't actually representative of the culture? That does happen. One very characteristic class of artifact found on Hassunan and related sites is tokens. These are small objects made of clay, often in geometric forms. It's been suggested that they form part of an inventory system that would ultimately lead to the development of writing. The implication of their discovery in these sites is that even in Hassunan times, they're playing some role in local economies, which would imply a more complex production system than had existed before that. Hassunan farmers practiced rain-fed agriculture. This is much like the agricultural systems that we're familiar with from much of the Western world. They involve cereal agriculture and are dependent on the provision of rainfall, reasonably reliable rainfall through the growing season in order to generate reasonable returns. And what this does, this dependence on rain-fed agriculture limits the spread of agriculture in Mesopotamia because there's some areas of southern Mesopotamia that are really too dry for reliable rain-fed agriculture to be worthwhile. It is important, however, to remember that the agricultural expertise of Hassunan and contemporary farmers made possible all of the social and political developments that would follow. Everything that we're talking about through this lecture is taking place through the labor and efforts of farmers. Hassunan craftspeople made elaborately decorated ceramics, a practice that is also found in later farming communities in this region that I'll talk about in a moment. And as we're going to see, these ceramics are actually fairly important. The Hassunan is overlapped and succeeded in Mesopotamia by the Halafian tradition, which generally exists within the same territory and is dated to about 5500 to 4700 BC. The Halafian is in many ways quite similar to the Hassunan tradition, and it's quite likely that there's a lot of continuity between the two. So we should think perhaps of Halafian as a development of Hassunan. Economically, it's quite similar. Socially, it's quite similar. Without evidence for large villages or much wealth differentiation. Again, the agricultural system is rain-fed. One primary difference here lies in the widespread nature of the Halafian pottery tradition, which is found, as you'll see here, through a huge area from the Mediterranean coast of Anatolia in what's now Turkey to northern Iraq. This pottery seems to have been a luxury ware, very heavily and very beautifully decorated, as you'll see. And the designs appear to be similar to those on later textiles, on fabrics from the region in later time periods. Unusually, and this is quite significant now, Halafian ceramics appear to have been made by specialists. This is not a circumstance in which a whole variety of people in the community are making pottery. This pottery seems to be made by craftsmen who are really specialized in this activity. The vessels are very standardized. And archaeological analysis of the clays and tempers used in Halafian pottery indicates that at least some of this pottery was being traded or distributed in some ways over regions of perhaps 1,000 kilometers or 500 to 600 miles. This implies a widespread and quite efficient trading system, since pottery, as we all know, is relatively heavy and relatively fragile. So this requires, this demands some sort of system for moving this pottery around that was relatively efficient. We haven't really seen a trading network of this sort anywhere in the world before this, that's trading what appears to be a luxury good, a fragile, heavy luxury good, over long distances. Halafian pottery may well have been an elite item. There's that term, elite. And its distribution may indicate the spread of a common elite aesthetic through relatively large areas of the Near East, as I said, from northern Iraq to Anatolia. This is a form of display, if you like. And we're going to see this kind of arrangement in other areas of the world. A general theme of widespread elite culture over a large area, but overlaying more localized material culture associated with common people. Why would one do this? What's the significance here of these widespread distributions of elite objects? Well, we think of the world as we know it today. This is actually fairly easy to understand. We still have an association of exotic goods, goods that come from far away. They're associated with rarity, with far-flung contacts. Oh, I bought this suit in Paris or Berlin. I didn't actually, but if I had, this might be something that I would let people know about. It comes from far away. It reveals my cosmopolitanism. And this distribution of Halafian ceramics probably indicates the same sort of process of work. With Halafian, As with the earlier Hasunan tradition, we find small tokens and stamp seals appearing on Halafian sites. So small stamps that are used to seal usually objects in clay. They may again have been used to mark items for inventory, probably to mark possession, so indicating the presence of substantial private or familial property and more complex economic relations than had existed in earlier times. These traditions, the Hasunan and Halafian traditions in northern Mesopotamia, are paralleled further to the south by a tradition that's called the Samarran, which existed between about 6,000 and 5,000 BC at places like Tel Aswan and Chogamami in what's now central Iraq near Baghdad. Samarran may be, again, at least in part, descended from the Hasunan culture in northern Mesopotamia. Elaborate Samarran pottery is again found over a wide area of central Mesopotamia, although not as large as Halafian. It probably had generally similar uses as a luxury good and a valued possession of elites. One crucial difference, and this is extraordinarily significant, between Samarran and the cultures to the north, is that in central Mesopotamia, Samarran communities used fairly developed irrigation agriculture. They're living in environments that would have been marginal for rain-fed agriculture, and so irrigation agriculture was a necessity. The productivity of this agricultural system would provide the basis for later developments toward the state in southern and central Mesopotamia. We have to remember, even as I spoke in the last lecture about cultural evolution, we have to remember that theorists like V. Gordon Child, talking about the appearance of the state, specifically credit the importance of not merely agriculture, but irrigation agriculture. And really the productivity of these irrigation agriculture systems probably in part explains at least why we see states developing in southern Mesopotamia before they do in surrounding areas. A new product as well. Flax was grown on at least some Samarran sites. This lay the basis for an export in textiles, linen in this case, that would be an important element in later Mesopotamian trading systems. Here we have a sort of an agricultural product, but an agricultural product that can again be turned into a valuable good and traded over long distances. It can be decorated in the same way as pottery, and in fact some of the decorations on Hasunan and Halafian and now Samarran pottery actually resemble decorations on textiles. It can be moved around, and it can be, again, used as an exotic good, as a marker of how well-connected and cosmopolitan and wealthy one is. Samarran sites are also, in some cases, substantially larger than those found further to the north in Hasunan and Halafian communities. Some of these Samarran sites probably housed 800 to 1,200 people. The scale of social systems is now increasing. Characteristic of the larger Samarran sites are distinctive T-shaped buildings, probably used as storehouses for seed and food grain, and possibly indicating some form of communal ownership of productive land. When I say communal ownership, it's unclear the scale of that communal ownership. Would this be communal ownership on the part of the entire community of a site, for example, like Tel Assuan, the type site, you remember that term, for the Sumerian tradition? Would it be communal ownership on the level of, for example, a kinship group, a particular lineage or clan, for example? Would it be communal ownership that might be associated with worship at a particular temple? Because what we're going to see is that the relationship between storage of food and storage of other goods and temples, places of religious worship, is actually very close in developing states in Mesopotamia. So perhaps we see some of that even as far back as the Sumerian period. At least Tel Assuan and Chogomami appear to have been fortified through at least part of their occupation, with a wall running around the site at Tel Assuan, for example. This implies the necessity of defense against attack by other communities, with all of the implications for conflict, for the origins of warfare that we might expect. Judging from a cemetery at Tel Assuan, the people of that Sumerian community, at least, were quite prosperous. But interestingly enough, there's little variation in grave goods at the site, except according to age and sex. This suggests that wealth differences had not yet become significant on the site. As I said, cemeteries are one primary way in which archaeologists establish the importance of status and wealth differences in ancient societies. Although by no means the only way, in many societies, the way in which people are buried is a direct reflection, indeed a continuation, of their status in life. And you may remember that from Shital Hayuk. The idea that ancestors continue to be ancestors and continue to be socially important in their households and in the communities, even after they die, is a well-established principle in many areas of the world. Archaeologists argue about the level of political centralization in Halathian and Sumerian communities. Some claim that these were simple chiefdoms, others that they did not possess even that degree of political hierarchy. As I said, we do have some kinds of evidence accumulated that might bear on this question. The existence in Sumerian sites, for example, of communal structures that seem to have been not private households, but used by the entire community. Defensive walls, which are both an implication of organized warfare and also a significant communal activity. The building of those walls is a communal activity in and of itself. There are elite goods. If we understand, for example, Halathian and Sumerian ceramics as elite goods, those exist, but relatively little of such materials are found in tombs. It's an ambiguous picture, which is actually fairly characteristic of archaeological research in many areas of the world. For my next talk, I'll cover continuing developments in a somewhat different area. We're now going to move the focus to southern Mesopotamia, which is where developments towards states and civilizations will really begin. Thank you.